the topic specifically is the supply side dash resources, natural resources, the resources of the earth. Resources mean the things that we as humans want and try to get. So this is specifically what we're going to talk about, and it's really in the geologist's realm to explore for and find resources that people want. Now, after they have been found, then the geologist loses his expertise in what is done with them beyond that point. But I think we can still speak to it. It's mainly the economist and the theologian and people who are concerned about how things are used in our society that mainly we would be talking about. And so we're having sessions on that kind of thing also this week. Now, by way of introduction, I just want to call your attention to the fact that our Creator really has endowed us with a tremendous capacity to explore and to find things in our environment. And this is a God-given gift, certainly a major resource in itself, is our own mental capacity to put things together and do these things. Our Creator has also given us a great appetite for consumption. And this presents us with some problem, because that appetite is virtually insatiable. You can hardly get enough to really be satisfied. And so that presents us with a problem as we begin to look at the supply side in particular. Now, I also call your attention to the fact that the human species, we as a human family, have done something within the environment, obviously, that no other animal could do. We have extended our environment beyond just the surface of the earth, where all animals and plants live and derive their resources, except for us. We dig into the earth in the third dimension, and we extract things from the earth and bring them to the surface and make them a part of our environment. Furthermore, now we're stretching our minds to think about outer space. And there are those that tell us that we needn't worry about the supply of things on Earth, because soon we can go and capture a meteorite, a satellite of one of the other planets or whatever, and bring it into Earth and use it. Well, this is again an example of our creativeness and our ability to at least think about these things. Now, when we come to think about nature then, as we think about this topic, we seek to control nature. We want nature so that we can manage it. And we do everything possible, in many cases, to actually control. And unfortunately, the biblical interpretations have come down much too heavy on subduing the earth and really making it available to ourselves as individuals, rather than the concept that rather we should have of tending to the earth and carefully managing it and this kind of thing. So that is another thing. Our place in the environment and in the hierarchy of all life is really the one of a manager. We are the only species capable of managing God's creation. That's our stewardship. And so there's a very important point to be understood in relationship to our existence and that kind of an understanding. So many of the resources, you see, that we want and use are really held in common with all life to some degree. And so as we look at the things that are actually essential to all life in terms of resources, we must have sunshine, we must have water for all life, and we must have fresh air that's unpolluted. We must have food, which means in turn that one of the most precious resources we have is our soil. Our soil. It takes a long time to produce good soil. And as a matter of fact, those of you who are here, you know, you haven't gotten any clay on your feet up here. Time has not been sufficient since the ice melted out in this valley to allow for the rocks to decompose to the point where they form the essential material of mud. You know, you maybe don't think mud is important. The chemist would simply call it hydrous aluminum silicate. But when you get it on your shoes, you call it mud. Well, mud is the connection between the inanimate and the animate. It's the connection between the rocks, which have no life, and life itself, which derives its food from the decomposition of the rocks, plus the sunshine, chlorophyll, the plants, and all. It's all linked together. And so whatever you do to any one of these resources, you see, you really do to all of them. So that's one of our precious resources, soil. And we're losing a lot of it these days. And it's one of our major concerns as a result of erosion and exploitation. In many senses, we're essentially mining. We're mining and extracting the good things out of the soil and not putting them back fast enough. So that's one of our problems. In terms of resources and reserves, I'm going to talk a little about this later. Resources are something that we want. The reserves are really what is available. And not all of it is available. So that's a distinction we'll have to make. Now, in our economy and our lifestyle, you see, depends a lot on how we view consumption versus raw materials. And the important thing we have to think about is that we have been given the freedom to choose. We can do, as individuals, what we wish to do, up to the point of actually putting ourselves in jeopardy in terms of survival. But we still have the free choice. So it's up to us, you see, to deal with this in whatever way we wish. Finally, God's intention and Jesus was to redeem all of creation, not just mankind, humankind, but all of creation. And this is the important thing that we need to remember. Now, I've brought a few books up this year from the library because what I'm going to give you this morning, believe it or not, is the condensation of a semester course. And we deal with this for a whole semester. And I'm trying to pick up some highlights from that in an hour. Now, obviously, that can't be done, but we're going to do it anyway, the best we can. So I'll call your attention to things that are over in the library. And here's one, Farming God's Land by Charles Lutz. And here is, in my view, one of the best things you could take a look at. That's energy for the next 20 years. And it's a very important document. Here is environmental geology, a brand new 1981 text. And this kind of thing you can go over to the library and look at. Furthermore, if you don't like such a big book, I've got smaller ones. In smaller packages. So here's a whole stack, each one of them dealing with the topic we're discussing this morning. So we can't review all of these now, but as you wish, go have a look at them. Then finally, I'll call your attention to a little booklet I was asked to write, summing up these things, and it's an outgrowth of our concerns here at Holden Village, our Science and Technology Committee, and various things that we have dealt with. So I've kind of put it into a little booklet here, which Augsburg has published for the ALC, and that's available over in the bookstore. Mary makes a few cents off of it, so it's only $1.75, so you might want to pick that up. You see, this is kind of my economic system. It's a little different than what you might hear in other sessions. Really, it's sharing. And so you might think about that and see what we might do about it. Now, in the course of the hour, let me just review what we're going to talk about and then see at the end of the hour how much of it we got through. First of all, I want to talk about North America as a land mass, the physical characteristics of North America. Then I want to talk a little about energy and all of the resources of energy. Specifically, I want to talk about solar, wood, coal, petroleum, geothermal, uranium, and various science and technology, which really is a resource in getting at these things. And then the metal resources, the metals. Iron, copper, aluminum, the alloy metals of steel, zinc, lead, silver, gold, platinum, and so on. The non-metallic mineral resources that we need to be aware of are particularly the ones that are the fertilizers, the cement, the concrete, the sand, the gravel, the sulfur, and the salt. And all of these are important things for life. And then finally, we need to maybe think something about shelter and clothing, because as the human species moved north into the cold climates and south into the colder climates, it was necessary for some protection in terms of shelter and clothing. And it's been pretty necessary here the last week or so, as we've all noted. So that's a big topic for this morning, and at the risk of doing too much, I'm at least going to show you a number of things, and we'll try and move through it rather rapidly, and I'll keep my eye on the clock here and see that we don't spend too much time on each of these various kinds of topics that we could discuss. Now, first of all, let's take a look at the most important thing we need to remember is that the sun is the source of all energy that we deal with. Energy is the ability to do work, and it's the prime mover, you see, of everything. So the sun coming here, the sun's energy is in place into the forest, and it's into the agricultural land and land areas. And it's also in the ocean, but a certain part of it gets buried into the Earth's crust. And that gets buried into the Earth's crust is down at the bottom of this chart and shows that that's the fossil fuels. This is the pent-up sunshine of the past, locked up in plants as coal and in oil, you see, as derived from organic material, thousands and millions of years before the present. All right, the sun then is a very important source. Looking at the United States in terms of sunshine, I'm not going to dwell on this. You all know where the sun shines most and where it shines least, and this is just a map to show it. Let's look at the bottom part of the chart here. This U.S. energy sources since the year 1850. And here's 1850 over here. And notice that wood was the big source, you see, until 1900, and now it tapers off. Here's 1975, and over here, the year 2020. Now, let's look at coal. Coal came in, you see, but it has not been used extensively until past 1900. And then going on, you can see the use of coal. And coal is bound to become much more important as we go further into the future. Petroleum, the fossil fuels, you see, began around 1900 to become important. And in 1976 and right up to now, you see, three-fourths of all of our energy right now, three-fourths, comes from petroleum and natural gas. So that's where we are today. Now, why is the line going down? For the simple reason that all of these resources are exhaustible. And finally, we pump it all out. And when it's all pumped out, then we have to look at other things. So that the oil will decrease in its importance to the year 2020. And then we look at natural gas, the same profile. And then we look at hydropower and geothermal. Well, these are things that can increase. And when you get to that point, you see over here in 2020, one of the things you observe is that there's more energy being used here at this point, 1981, than there is over here. The prediction is that we'll use less energy. That means that we're going to change our lifestyles. And many of the things that you do now that are energy intensive are going to, the energy isn't going to be available, for one thing. And so we're basically going to change our lifestyles and do things differently. Well, that remains to be seen. Now, I want to spend just a minute on this particular chart because it's critical to our understanding of the environment and what we have. One of the most confusing things you read in the newspapers is, you know, different people's opinion about what we have still available in terms of oil, coal, uranium, whatever it is in relationship to energy. And the thing I want you to be crystal clear about is that there are two different words, and they're sometimes misused, and they should not be misused. The resource, you see, is one thing. That's the whole thing. Let's say it's coal. It's coal. That's the resource. But not all coal that we know of in the world is available to us. Much of it is too deep. There's a lot of it that's under cities that we don't want to dig out because things cave in. Much of it cannot be extracted because it is not economically feasible to get it out. Now, that is the key thing in terms of reserves. Reserves would be that amount of coal that with the present technology is economically feasible to get out and use. And that's all that we have in the way of reserves. Now, if the price goes up and it's more economic and it becomes more economical for whatever reason to extract more of this coal resource, then we'll increase the reserve. But the reserve is a kind of a banker's figure. It's the kind of thing you can go to the bank and say, I have this much that's recoverable, loan me the money to develop it. And the banker can agree because he knows he's going to get his money back. And that's the way the term reserve is used. Resources, you see, are hypothetical in many cases. They're conditional upon certain environmental things. And some of them are strictly speculative, you see. But the geologist looks at the whole realm, the whole spectrum. And the geologist then tries to put figures on these things in terms of tons and so on. So that is our understanding then of all materials. We look at them from the point of view of both a resource and the actual reserves that are available to us. Now, let's look at the U.S. energy mix at the present time. What are we using for energy right now? And this is in terms of quads, which is million billion British thermal units. All right, that's a measurement of the energy derived from each of these things. domestic oil, you see, here in 79, 80, let's just look at the figures in 81. Here is over 30%, you see, of all energy. All energy comes from the from that source, from domestic oil. Natural gas, almost an equal amount. And foreign oil, you see, so when you add these three together, that's the big source of energy in our country at this time. Then, in addition to that, coal is a small figure here. And actually, it's a much smaller figure than petroleum. And we just have not gotten into using coal extensively at this point. Why? Oil and gas are just too cheap. And they're still much too cheap. It'd be much better if they were more expensive. At least gasoline, another dollar a gallon. Then we'll begin to use coal and other resources rather than just the fossil fuel. Coal-based electricity, you see, and here's gas, electricity from gas, and hydro is a small amount. Nuclear is very small. And from foreign oil, we don't get much of our electricity from that, and so on. So that's just a kind of an overview, you see, of where our energy is coming from at the present time. Now, we'll take a look at coal, because coal is the most abundant of all of the natural resources that we have. And if we look at it from a world point of view, let's just look at the position, see, of the United States. Here's America. The geological resources, now you understand what I mean when I say resources, as opposed to reserves over here. So the United States has over a million 10 to the 6th tons. That's over a billion, you see, tons. And so the United States, and this amount is actually recoverable. Now, when you compare America with all of the rest of the continents, you can see that America has a favored position in a lot of these natural resources. We have good supplies of coal, one of the best in the world, because as you look at the United States compared with China, and the USSR, they have much more. But in terms of reserves that are actually available, you see, ours compares very favorably with reserves throughout the world. So we have a favored position in terms of coal. And that's one of our main sources of energy in the future. So as we need this, we'll extract it and use it. But I want to call your attention now to a chart here which shows really what the problem is. World population is increasing. And that we know from 1830 here until 2180. This is a forecast of what world population will look like. That doesn't actually have figures on it, but that's the trend. Now, in terms of resources, renewable resources, you see, this is 1980 right here. 1980, renewable resources are decreasing. And exhaustible resources, you see, are what's being used instead. We're using oil and coal and the exhaustible kinds of things. So we're mining it out and using it, and that will go on, you see, until it comes to a point where it's no longer available. Then something has to take over. And it's the sustainable kinds of resources that then have to be relied on if we're going to keep our lifestyle and keep things moving in the economy. If we're going to have energy, it has to come from some other source. And that's the kind of thing that we need to be watching. Now, let me show you this as something. This is simply a few of the kinds of things we could make from coal instead of burning it up. You know, it's one of the most valuable chemical sources that we have in the Earth's crust. And we really should not be using our coal, simply burning it. It's too valuable to burn. And the same kind of a chart could be shown for oil and gas. All of you are wearing, I'm sure, something that comes from oil and gas today. Fibers of all kinds, you see, nylons and various fibers. The synthetics, they come from oil and coal. And so they're too valuable. We ought to be using them because as the population increases, the need for all of these things increases. It'd be much better if we didn't burn coal, if we simply saved it for use in the future. Now, since oil is the most important single material, I want to have us get an understanding of where these reserves, now we're speaking of reserves, these are actual barrels that the geologist knows where they are and that they can be brought out at a profit and delivered to society. Now, notice this column. Now there's too much on here for you to follow, so let's follow only the green. Now the green are figures for 1979 on a worldwide basis, and that's the latest figures that are available worldwide. Now if you notice here, the 349, that refers to the Persian Gulf area. So the Persian Gulf area has the bulk of all of the oil known in the world. They have the big chunk of it. And it's mainly from Saudi Arabia. We get large imports from there. And from Kuwait. We used to get them from Iran. But you can see that these figures over here are all substantial figures. And then when we come to the United States and North America, you see the total for North America is 62. And that, a good part of that, half of that, is in Mexico. Mexico has more oil today than we have in reserves, and that has just been found in the last 5 to 10 years. So that they're building up their reserves, we're depleting ours. So that in North America is not anywhere near any like this column. Russia has a great potential, and actually more than North America has, and Siberia is a virtual gold mine in the sense, or a bonanza in the sense of natural resources, but obviously very difficult to get out, so that the development of it is very, very difficult. Here's South America, really a much smaller quantity, limited mainly to Venezuela, and then Indonesia coming up, Nigeria, one of the important ones in Africa, and then Western Europe. So you can see the chart at least tells you, just at a glance at it, where the oil can of the world really is, and that's important. I'd like to just show you the figures at the bottom of this chart, just to kind of give you an idea of what the situation is. I'll move it up here where we can see it a little better. You know, the United States has 516,000 oil wells. Now, that's a lot of oil wells. And we produce from those wells 8 million plus barrels a day, every day, more than 8 million barrels. And that averages out about 17 barrels per well. Now, let's look at the Mideast, the Persian Gulf. They have only 3,600 oil wells, and those 3,600 produce 21 million barrels a day. That means that their wells average over 5,000 barrels a day against our 17 barrels a day. Well, that's the facts of the supply side. You see, those are the statistics on a worldwide basis. And now, as we have found our oil early, developed our economy based on cheap oil and cheap gas, and basically what we've done is to use it up to a great degree, so that in terms of reserves, we just do not have the great numbers of barrels left that we used to have. Let's take a look at what the situation looks like on a chart. From 1945, the reserves went up as more drilling until we got to 1960, 70, and then we hit one big strike up in Alaska, the North Slope, Prudhoe Bay. And that boosted it, you see, from there clear up to here. Now, we have not found, in the time since that discovery, there have been no more big finds up in the Alaska area or any place else in North America. We have every drilling rig running that's available anywhere in the United States and Alaska, and we're coming up with lots of oil. In fact, it's producing a glut on the market because lots of little fields, lots of small wells, but no big fields. And it's the big fields that give the big boost to what's left to be produced. So you see, that's the problem. Now, when we ask the experts, how much do we have left to actually discover and produce from now until way out into the future? Figures vary. And be reminded that this is more an art than a science, because we cannot pin this down. Nobody knows exactly. But this is the best opinion, and it varies all the way from 88 billion barrels more to 113 billion barrels more that we can still find in the North American environment, you see. So that's an important thing. Well, the final chart that I want to show you is really what it looks like when you look at it in terms of the future. Now, the top chart shows the cycle for world coal production. This is the whole world now. And it shows that starting in 1800 here's where we come in, 1900, here's 2000, 2100, 22, 23, and on out to 2600. Now, it shows that by that time you can be optimistic or you can be relatively conservative. If you take the top line, you see it'll go on out this far and will produce more. If you're on the conservative side of the estimates, then it looks more like the bottom line. And in either case, it comes to an end. You look at the bottom line for petroleum, oil production, you see from 1950 to the year 2050, we will produce the big bulk of all the oil in the world. And at that point, then we have to rely on something else. So that is the situation. 80% of it, according to this figure, will be produced in 58 years. And we're right into the middle of that right now, you see. And so that's why. Here's 1981, right in here. So that's one of the problems. All right. Now, I'm going to skip some of these things because our time will get away from us, I know. I'll just remind you that one of the other things that is very much in society's mind this day is the availability of energy from nuclear sources. And we have very strong opinions about whether we want nuclear or whether we don't want it. But one opinion, at least from a geological point of view, if we go with the standard kinds of nuclear plants, which is fission, where you break up the atoms to get the energy, there's a limited supply of uranium. That's limited. That's like coal. It's like oil. And it's depletable. We'll use it up. And so if there is to be an alternative, we have to think of it in terms of the breeder plant, where without going into this, you can see that you put in this kind of material, which has that percentage of plutonium and uranium oxide. And you hit it with a neutron, and it breaks apart, and it produces another one just like the one that you bombarded. And you get a material down here that is uranium-238. That's a byproduct, which can be bred up to be this material, plutonium-239. The physicists know how to do this. And you can then, and you put this back in, you see, as new stock, and you actually create material as you produce energy. And you keep that going. What's wrong with it? The thing that's wrong with it is the fear of plutonium, because plutonium is the basic material for the bomb, you see, the hydrogen bomb. And that is a major concern in society, and it's one of the things that we have to deal with. France, this was a picture of one of the major plants in France, and they're going for it. But I think with a new administration, even in France, they're beginning to take another look at it. Well, let me remind you that forecasts are not accurate all the time. In fact, they're probably never accurate, but they're a kind of a guideline into the future. So let's look at this. 1970, this is the distribution, the actual distribution of how energy was supplied. Domestic oil, small amount of oil imports, and domestic natural gas and coal. Now the forecast, you can see just looking across, the thing that is wrong here that you can see is that nuclear, which was forecast by 1980 to be a major part of our energy, is not a major part of our energy. We have voted that out pretty much. And instead of that, in 1985, you see, we're not going to have anything near that kind of a picture. The other thing that's changing is that oil imports are now beginning to decrease because of conservation and because we've raised the price and we're more careful about how we use oil. And so we're importing less. And this forecast, you see, was made in the early 70s. And it's not entirely accurate. And so as you look at forecasts, remember that this is an art, not an exact science. Now, I want to show you a problem with our energy. Here's the energy going in from these various sources. Let's just look at them. Nuclear, natural gas, coal, petroleum. And it shows a flow chart. What's it going to be used for? It's going to be used to make electrical energy. And it's going to be used for residential and commercial, for industrial purposes, for non-energy, such as synthetics, you see, and things like that, and for automobiles and buses and airplanes and so on. Now, the thing that's impressive here is that when you get over to this side of the chart, you can see that 45% of the energy is useful, and the rest of the energy is simply wasted. It's wasted. It goes into the air as heat, or it is not used. And this is one of the great things that we have in terms of conservation. If we can cut out the waste of energy, you see, we have a great, that's the most potential source for energy there is today, is that kind of availability. Now, I think I'll skip through the report that I was going to tell you about was the Ford report, the next 20 years of energy, and I'll just let you take a look at it if you wish here in the library, and that's a very important document dealing with energy. So I think now we'll go on and talk about some other things. I'd like to next get into the soil and an understanding of why North America is really the breadbasket of the world. Now, if you just visualize with me the situation we have in North America. See, North America extends really from the North Pole almost down to near the equator. It's by the time you got down into Central America. Think of the Gulf Coast, and I don't have a map in front of me here, so you'll have to use your thinking cap. But from the southern part of North America to the northern part, we have almost a complete spectrum of the climatic conditions. We have it very warm in the south, very cold in the north. Now, the thing that happened a few thousands of years ago was that the glaciers began to form in the north. The climate changed, and it scraped off the soil and the loose material from Canada and northern Minnesota and moved it down into Iowa and Illinois and that part of the country. So it was a great deposit of this loose material, wonderful for producing a good soil and holding a lot of water. Then think about the other factor in North America, the fact that the Gulf Coast is to the south and that the winds circulate from the south to the north, because when the air, you see, is cooled, it falls, and when it's warm, it rises, and this produces a current. And those currents flow from the south to the north. And the rotation of the earth funnels it right into the Gulf of Mexico and brings it right up between the Appalachians and the Rocky Mountains. And so the Midwest has an assured supply of good rain so that they get enough rain every year to make a good crop. And that's a built-in ventilation system that no other continent in the world has. And this is one of the great failings that Russia has just because of its environment. Why? Because on the south side of Russia, there are mountains running east-west all the way across. And the moisture gets trapped on the south side, and India gets too much at different times. And as you go north into China and into Russia, they simply do not get enough. And we can raise food and export it better than any other country in the world. So from the point of view of world supplies of food, we really are the breadbasket of the world, in the same way that the Persian Gulf is the oil can of the world. You see, so that it's fortunate that the Earth's natural resources are divided up. We have things to trade with one another, and that's important. And that's one of the things that I wish we had time to consider. And in my class in college, when we work with this, we really spend days at this. And we work with the soil forming processes and the development, you see, of good soils, good clays, and how these things occur. And it takes time to explain all of this. So I'm not even going to try, you see, in the next few minutes. But this is a very exact kind of science, soil science, pedology. And a great deal is known about it, so that we can study it and know more about it. And let me just show you a very complex chart, just enough to whet your appetite, and we won't try to explain it. But look at ordinary granite. Ordinary granite, and that's what we have here, a lot of it. And if you think of that, it's made up of minerals, very common minerals. And those minerals are made up of chemicals. And some of those chemicals that I've outlined in red are vulnerable to the presence of water and air. So when they're exposed to water and air, they decompose. They rot, in a sense, and dissolve. And actually, what happens is that these materials get removed so that the potassium and the sodium and the iron and the calcium and the magnesium that's in a granite or any other rock is released into the environment. Where does it go? It goes to the oceans, and then it becomes a part of the sedimentary rocks that form from the ocean. So it becomes a chemical. It's dissolved. So the solid rock becomes liquid in part. And what's left behind, you see, is aluminum and silicon and oxygen. And so when you get down here, here's clay, the common thing, mud, that we talked about. Here's where the mud comes from. And so what we have is hydrous, water, aluminum, silicate. And that's what clay is, and it comes from these minerals, you see, here. The same way with the basalt. That's what you have out on the Columbia Plateau. And it's gradually breaking down. And the iron is coming out, and the calcium, and the magnesium. And so that provides then a release of these chemicals, and the end product, again, is soil. So it all produces clay in the final analysis, the insoluble residue, you see, of what's left over. All right, the thing I mentioned too is that we're concerned that this is really our most important resource. If we could name anything number one, I would think we would want to say that soil is certainly high on the list. But we're losing a lot of soil. And this is from the Agricultural Department figures, the computations, and they tell us that topsoil is being eroded at the rate of 4 billion tons per year. Now, it takes thousands of years to break the rock down to form that. Once that's gone, it's gone. It's a depletable kind of thing. We lose our soil. We lose the capacity to raise the plants, to raise the crops, to feed ourselves and the rest of the world. That's simply going down the Mississippi River and each river, you see, and it's a product of erosion. And 1 million acres each year is being lost to urban development. We simply pave over it. It's gone, you know, and it's not productive beyond that point. 3/5 of the farmland in the United States is cared for improperly. Well, we haven't been concerned about this. We raise more food than we can eat, you know, and our land is so productive that we don't concern ourselves with them. But project that trend for 1,000 years or 10,000 years, and what's going to happen to the soils, you see, so that our food is dependent on our soil. And that's why soil, you see, is one of the major resources. And in terms of North America, it is most important because we have a greater share of it than any other country in the world. So much for soil and food. Now, let's look at another topic. United States strategic materials. Now, let me just pick out a few of these that are important. You can see that the percentage imported here, meaning if we import 100%, it means we don't have it. You know, so it's something that we need but do not have. So we import and we pay somebody else for it. You see, all the way from 100% here down to 3% of things that we use. Here's cobalt and manganese. Cobalt and manganese are absolutely essential in making steel. You can't make steel without these added materials. And we import, you see, 98-99%. Where does it come from? Brazil, Gabon, Australia, and South Africa. Here, cobalt from South Africa, you see, in Finland and Norway and Canada and so on. But we don't have it in the United States. That's important. Let's pick out another important one, aluminum. Think of all the aluminum that we use in this country. We have not 1 ton, really, of good aluminum ore in this country. In the United States of America, we have no aluminum ore. and we're the major user in the world of aluminum. So where do we get it? Well, we have to get it from other places, Jamaica, Suriname, Australia, and the Dominion Republics. It's mainly around the equator, and it's a kind of product that where the aluminum is concentrated by nature at the surface. There are no mines for aluminum. They're mainly surface accumulations of aluminum. It's soil which you have taken the silica out of and just left the aluminum oxide. And that's really all it is. So that's a very important one. As you go on down here, platinum. Platinum is a very important thing, and mainly it comes from South Africa, or the other place we get it is from Russia. Well, we need that material. It's essential in industry. And so if we're going to do the things we normally do, we have to have platinum. Not for jewelry, but for industry. We get down here as gold, and that's not that important. But iron obviously is, and even iron now, we're depleting our resources of good iron to the point that we import almost a third of the iron that goes into steel. We have to import. And I remember as a student at Augustana College, I used to go up there in the 1930s, and here were the iron mines, you know, the iron mountain ranges, whole ranges that were being dug up with huge shovels and converted into steel. Now you go back up there and take a look, and all you see is a big hole, and there's none of the good iron left. That would run 65% iron. Now the iron that's left is what's around the edges, and that runs 35%. And you have to have a taconite process in order to make it beneficially rich enough that the steel mills can use it. That's all that's left up in that part of the country. The same way with copper, the Keweenawan Peninsula, where the copper was available just by scooping it up. It was already on the surface, pure copper. That's used, and we're no longer have that available. So we've gotten a lot of good mileage out of what we found, but the point is, once you extract it, it's gone. And it doesn't come back, you see, until nature brings it back millions of years in the future, possibly. All right, here are some of the selected metallic minerals. Let's look at iron. We're just talking about iron ore. Here's 29% that we still have to import to satisfy our consumption. Okay, chromium, we have to import 64%. Where? South Africa, Rhodesia, the Philippines. Manganese, 84%. Let's see, again, South Africa. Nickel, 92%. Canada, Australia, and so on. Tin, 81%. These are all materials that we are deficient. We're a have-not nation in terms of these particular materials, and they are absolutely essential to the kind of economy that we have at the present. Now, aluminum is really one of the most spectacular of all. Why, I said we didn't have any ore, so why is it only 84%? Because we recycle. And we save aluminum cans, so we don't have to import 100%. So we recycle a lot of it, but when it comes to new aluminum, we have none in the United States, and we have to import it all from other places. Okay? And the chief metals that we do recycle are these. Iron, obviously, is the biggest bulk. And we recycle a lot of iron, and you can see that various things are recycled in significant amounts. One of the reasons for really collecting all of the refuse and recycling and thinking in a new lifestyle, you see, we've been a throwaway society, and we can no longer think in terms of just being a throwaway society. Now we can recover from just ordinary garbage, you know, solid waste. These are the kinds of materials that are recoverable. Obviously, it's easy to get out magnetic metals and iron and so on. Organic waste, glass, aluminum, paper, and plastics. All of these kinds of things are immediately recoverable if you have the attitude that this is important. So that the thing that's bringing us into a position of thinking some of these things are important is the prices. And when we have to pay enough for it, it hurts enough to buy it, then we think about recycling it, you know. So that the prices have really skyrocketed in these various areas, and that's good for us because it makes us conserve. And that's really where we ought to come down hard. As a church, we should be very strong for conservation of all kinds. Now, in the new space age, we're seeing a whole host of new materials. And metals that are essential for the military and for space of all kinds, you see, are new. Germanium, cobalt, chromium, and manganese, platinum. These are the most critical, you know, among a whole list of lesser things, but these are absolutely very critical. All right, so much for that. Let's look now at another important resource, water. Perhaps this is the easiest way to just visualize the situation in relationship to water. Lots of water in the oceans, but there's a lot of water tied up in ice, you see, and that's really not readily available. And there's this much fresh water and that much water vapor. Well, okay, that gives you a picture of what water is. Water is one of our most critical resources. Now, let's just look at the at a statistic or two here for fun and see what that looks like. Stream flow per day. That's all the water in all the rivers, all the streams in the country. You see, in the United States, 1,200 billion gallons per day. In 1970, we used 400 billion per day. In 2000, we'll probably use something like 800. Well, the next step, you see, we're beginning to approach the critical use and availability of fresh water. And if you look at it where we're safe, you know, in the United States, there are only about three areas where we can be assured of enough water in the future. And the problems are related to many other things, and I think the one obviously that's most on our minds is the pollution of water, you know. And within recent times now, we have gotten at some of the political side of this and began to pass laws that relate to water pollution. And so by 1985, every stream was supposed to be cleaned up. Congress said so, but Congress didn't appropriate the money for it. And the cities and the states, you see, that were charged with doing this, well, we've done quite a bit of it, but we have not been able to do all of it. It hasn't been a top priority, you see, in the country to keep the water pollution down. The public is becoming very conscious of it. The Supreme Court is being asked to rule on various things. And so we are getting at it. You know, we have said it is important and we are going to do something about it. So that's a favorable sign, and I hope that we continue that. But it's hard to do everything else that we want to do and still preserve everything that we want to preserve as a resource. Now, when we decide we're going to dig the coal out and pump the oil out and burn it at the surface, we're going to create a certain amount of things that are foreign to clean air. It's not the kind of air that we have outside the door. In other words, we load the air with all of these things that you see here. We put solid particles, nitrogen, hydrogen, sulfur, carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, and carbon dioxide, you see over here, and we create heat in the atmosphere. All of these things are unnatural, and we upset the balance by doing these things. The question is, we're the guinea pigs, and we don't know just how much of this we can do and still not put ourselves in jeopardy. That's the hard thing to know. And here, for example, just looking at carbon dioxide, this is what's happened since 1958 to 1976. This is an actual measurement of the carbon dioxide in the air at the Hawaiian Islands, which is as far away, you know, as you can get it from the industrial complex. That's what's in the atmosphere worldwide, and it keeps building up. Now, how critical is this? Well, again, I say we don't know how critical it is. Maybe the forests can absorb all of this, but if we deforest too much, then the forest obviously is not there to be a sink for it. Well, one of our problems going along with the gross national product is the gross garbage product, you see, the gross national garbage. And when you think that today you're responsible for 100 pounds in some way, you see, for every person there's 100 pounds of garbage that accumulates today and every day. Now, that's a kind of a staggering figure, you know, when you think about it. So, let's take a look at another measure. One of the things that we're beginning to do, and this is the hopeful sign, we're starting to measure the impact on the environment of various kinds of things. And so we are working with timber and soil. This goes from 1969, when this was started, until 1980. And you can see that in terms of timber, we're making progress because we're replanting the trees. When we cut them down, we plant a new one. And we've insisted that that be done, and it's helping. Soil, we have not gotten tough enough with our soil concerns. We're losing ground in terms of keeping our soil intact. So that's one we're losing. Living space, we're not doing well on living space. That still is a problem. Wildlife, we're gradually making some progress, but it's kind of nip and tuck. And minerals, no. We're losing ground constantly on minerals. Water still becomes a problem. Air, on the other hand, we're gaining in some progress in terms of that. So that's a hopeful sign. Well, I think this is, we got within one chart of completing this, and I'll just show you what it is. Trends, based on a computer analysis, you see, of all of this, the trend would say that resources will go down. Here's the year 2100. Population will go up to a point that it gets, where the environment really gets unbearable, then it will go down. And industrial output will follow on a downward trend. Pollution is one of our biggest problems. And that's the thing that makes the environment most uninviting for life to continue. So, they've figured out what it would take to stabilize all of these trends. Now, they said that, conditions to stabilize, zero population growth by 1975. Obviously hasn't happened. And as you look down, industrial growth, zero by 1990. No, that's not likely to happen. So we're not really headed for stabilization. Resources used at 25%, you see, reduction, you see. We're not doing that. And so as you look down the line, we haven't come to the point that this is our highest priority in doing these things yet. But this is one of the things that is pointed out in this particular book. You want to read it over in the library, you know, you can formulate your own ideas. Well, you've been very patient, and I thank you. And I think this then will conclude our discussion of the supply side. Just to give you something to think about, and I think that as the church and as members of it, our stewardship is very much in question here, and we need to be very careful about how we use these things, which are all gifts, you see. We had nothing to do with him placing them in the earth. We simply are here. And the hope is that as we turn the earth over to our children, it will not be any worse, and it should be better than when we came on board. So let's each do his or her part. Thank you very much.